We're holding on page 10 in Gittin, paragraph Daf Mem Vov Amud Aleph, towards the end of Os Yud Beis. Continuing on topics that are in this perek about things that the Chachamim made new rules, new takonis, mifnei tikkun olam, in order for society to function properly. So the Mishnah mentions another one. You can have a case where a man divorces his wife because she's making too many nidorim. And this is inappropriate in principle, as we learned in Masechta Nedarim. He can cancel his wife's Nedarim, but still not all kinds of Nedarim can he cancel, and whatever he feels, figures that it interferes with their relationship. Or there can be, because there's a shame rat, because there are bad rumors going about her that she's being unfaithful. So there can have a case where a man divorces his wife for such reasons. Keep in mind, this is long before Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom, where now with one of Rabbeinu Gershom's takonis, he can't divorce her against his will, against her will, but back then they didn't have that. Now, the problem is then that later on, now he might want to remarry her later. Nothing in principle wrong with that, but later on, what happens if in between she gets married to somebody else, where then, as the Torah says, he's not allowed to get remarried, he may say, you know what, now she seems to have improved. She seems to have turned over a new leaf. She's not as prone to making nidorim anymore. If I had known that kind of thing, I never would have divorced her in the first place, and then that creates a real problem, because then that calls into question the gift that he gave her back then in her new marriage. So the Chacham made a takana that instead we make him take a neder that he should never marry her again. And that has to be an irrevocable neder, as we'll talk about in a minute. So the Gemara says, Omer Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yosi, mipnei ma omru, why exactly that? Why did the Chachamim say hamotzi? Well, one reason. Why did the Chachamim say hamotzi es ishtoi mishim shem ra lo yachzir, that when he divorces his wife because of bad rumors going around about her? And we don't mean some bad rumors that you have, you know, bored souls start coming up with rumors about here. I mean, we're talking about where there is a certain basis to believe that those rumors are true. Anyway, lo yachzir, then he's not allowed to remarry her afterwards. Or mishim neder lo yachzir, and that if he divorced her because she's prone to making nedarim, then he also shouldn't remarry her. And we've learned before, by the way, that a nedarim that are left unfulfilled can have a terrible effect on the family. It can cause that their young children, Rahmanul Islam, die. So that would be another reason why the husband would have a reason to divorce her if he's prone to making nedarim. Anyway, why is that? Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yosi says, Shaloyu b'noisi sura prutus v'arayis v'nedarim. Precisely that, so that Jewish women shouldn't be so careless with arayis and with nedarim. So this way, it'll be a motivation for her. She doesn't want to get divorced. Back then, it was very hard. Even nowadays, but back then even more so, it was very hard on a divorced woman. So this way, it'll motivate her to save her marriage and not do these things. Therefore, we tell the husband, Emor lo, tell her, Hevi yadas, be aware, shum shem ra ani motziach, that I'm divorcing you because of the bad rumors about her, or mishum neder ani motziach, or that I'm divorcing you because you're prone to nedarim, and that will give her an opportunity to shape up rather than have to go through with a divorce. So the Gemara continues, Piska, then a quotation from the Mishnah. Now, so the Mishnah mentions the point that we make the husband take a neder that he's not going to divorce his wife. Now, that he's not going to remarry her, rather, I should say. And that way, there won't be any problem, like we said. This way, if later on he says, yeah, but I didn't know that she's going to turn over a new leaf. If I had known, I never would have divorced her. That doesn't matter, because anyway, he's made a neder that he can never remarry her. So he knows to begin with that it's irrevocable, and therefore he's not going to jump into it unless he's really sure that there's no other way out of it. The problem is, of course, if he makes such a neder, he can always be makir neder. So we have to find some way of making the neder irrevocable. So one opinion in the Mishnah is, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, kol neder sheyodu bo rabim lo yachzir. Any neder that the rabbim are aware of, lo yachzir, then he can't revoke that neder. He can't be makir that neder. Therefore, he wouldn't be able to remarry her. V'shelo yodu bo rabim, if the rabbim do not know about it, yachzir, then he would be able to be makir neder and remarry her. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, in other words, the difference is whether it was done in the presence of the rabbim and they know about it or not, as opposed to there are other opinions that when it's al das rabbim, based on the das of the rabbim, which is in fact the halacha, a neder al das rabbim, you can't be matur neder unless the Gemara mentions, unless it's for the purpose of doing a mitzvah. Anyway, so Omer Rabbi Shur ben Levi, my time is Rabbi Yehuda. Where does Rabbi Yehuda get that from? That depends whether it's known to the rabbim or not. Dichtiv, you have the story of the Givonim in Sefer Yoshua. You have the story that the Givonim are people, the Goyim, and members of one of the Knani nations, the Chivi, who live in the city of Givon and the area around that, which eventually ended up being part of the territory of Shevet Binyamin. They were worried about what's going to happen if the Jewish people fight against them. They see already that a couple of cities in Eretz Yisrael have fallen to the Jews. So they came up with a scheme. They sent some messengers pretending that they're from a faraway country and they want to make a treaty with the Jewish people. And they managed to fool them, and a peace treaty was made. We learned about them. We learned about them a little bit in Yevamos. They kind of joined the Jewish people as Choit Ve'etzim, Meshoy Ve'mayim. They became hereditary wood choppers and water drawers, but there was an issue against marrying them. We talked about over there in Yevamos, Rashi and Tosfos discussed the question of what exactly is the nature of the issue of intermarrying with them. Is there a Daraisa aspect of it because they're from the seven nations? Is it completely Darabanan? Is there a time limit on it? Eventually the Gemara says that David saw that they were very cruel people in the whole story with Shaul and his descendants, and therefore he declared that they can never intermarry into the Jewish people. In any case, so in the story itself, in Sefer Yehoshua, when it tells how, so again, they tricked the people into making a shavua with them, and then they found out a couple of days later that, hey, these guys are actually local goyim, and we have a mitzvah leisachayak on the Shoma, we're not allowed to leave any of the seven nations alive. But the pasuk says, "V'lehikum bnei Yisrael," the Jewish people did not kill them. Ki nishvu lahem nesiyei ha'eda, because the nesiyim of the congregation had sworn to them. Now, so what if they swore to them? Why aren't they matir neder? Must be because it was done by rabbim, it was done in the presence of the Jewish people, and therefore they couldn't be mevatel anymore. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says there, you see that if a neder is made in public, then you can't be matir neder. The Rabbanan, what are the Rabbanan answer to that? The Rabbanan who say that that's not the criterion. They say, after all, was the Shavua foul in the first place? It wasn't really even a valid Shavua. It was based on a mistaken premise. The Givonim messengers had told the Jews that we came from a faraway country. The Loibo, and in fact, they didn't come from a faraway country because they were from right nearby. Then a Shavua wouldn't be chal on them in the first place. The fact that the Jews didn't kill them is because of Kiddush Hashem, because the Goyim wouldn't realize that they wouldn't know about all this, that the Givonim had tricked them. They would think Jews are over on their Shavua. So because of that, they weren't matir it, not because technically they couldn't. Tosfos actually discusses in some detail over here the question, isn't it a Shavua levatalus a mitzvah? There's a general rule that a shavua to violate a mitzvah is not effective. If a person were to make a shavua, for example, I won't eat matzah on Pesach, or I won't put on tefillin or whatever, then it's ineffective. So here, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, loisachayak on the Shama, not to leave any member of the seven nations of Canaan alive. So if they made a shavua, they're going to leave these guys alive, and it turns out that they're from the seven nations, then anyway, it's an invalid shavua. There's also, by the way, Tosfos also deals as a side point with the question why the Givonim needed to do this anyway. Before the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael, they sent messengers to all the nations over there saying, you have three choices. You can either give up and leave, which the Gur Goshim did, which is why we have many places in Chumash where it mentions the nations and it leaves out the Gur Goshim. They went to North Africa. Then you have the second possibility was you can stay and accept Sheva Mitzvot and Noyach and servitude to the Jewish people, and you can stay where you are. Or the third possibility is you're going to fight and we're going to beat you. So the Givonim ended up doing the second possibility, but only after the fact. The question is why they needed to play a trick then. And there's a lot of discussion about it here in Tosfos and in some other places in Shas about the various possibilities. Is it that maybe that offer expired only? Maybe that offer was only before the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael. Once they crossed the Yarden, maybe that offer expired. So now the Givonim is sometime later, so therefore they can't use that. They can't use that option anymore, and the only way is to play this trick.
There's the fact on the Shomo is you can give them a choice of...
So that's the thing. So the choice was, you have these three choices. Lo yisachayak on the Shomo means if they don't want to accept either of the first two choices, they don't want to leave, and they don't want to accept Shev Mitzvot Menoyach and subjugation to the Jewish people, then you have to fight them in Lo yisachayak on the Shomo. So yeah, one explanation is that offer expired once the Jewish people crossed the Yarden, and here the Givonim only woke up later and realized, you know what, now we're in trouble, we better do something. The other possibility that Rishonim bring is that the offer still would have been valid, but the Givonim were trying to get out of, they didn't want the servitude and the subjugation to the Jewish people. They wanted to be accepted as equal members of a treaty. So now, when it turned out that they were lying, and in fact they were from there, then they lost out. They taka end up being servants. So in other words, they accomplished the same thing as they would have if they had accepted the second possibility in the first place. In any case, Tosfos discusses over here that Tosfos discusses a bunch of questions about all of this. One thing Tosfos mentions in this connection is Rabbi Yehuda. Now, the fact is, doesn't Rabbi Yehuda agree there would have been a chilul Hashem? The answer is no. If in fact you could be matir neder, then it wouldn't be a chilul Hashem. There would be matir neder. Everybody would know. It would become publicized that the Jewish people had made this shavur to them, but then afterwards they had been matir. Now they went and wiped them out because that's what you're supposed to do. And then Tosfos goes and discusses various other angles about it. They could have kicked them out of the country. At the time, they weren't even coming to be Megayer and to accept the Shem Mitzvah Nenayach, so they would have had every right to get them. So therefore, so the bottom line is, according to Rabbi Yehuda then, that again, they couldn't be Matu the Nedu because it was done by Rabbim, and according to the Chachamim, they could have, but they figured it would make a Chilul Hashem. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda, Tosfos says, counters, if they could have been Matu Nedu, there wouldn't be a Chilul Hashem because it would be obvious that they're Matu Nedu because it goes against the Torah, and that would be that. Further on in the perek, it talks about, again, we're still talking about things of Bnei Tukuna Olam, so it talks about more dinim involving pidyon shvuyim. We talked about yesterday that the Mishnah says that you don't redeem captives for more than they're worth, which is an example of Tukuna Olam, and then the Mishnah goes on to talk about a case where a yid goes and sells himself to goyim. If he's saying he's going to sell himself to the goyim, are we required, because he's, let's say he's in desperate financial straits, are we required to do something about it proactively, or do we say, you know what, if you sell yourself to the goyim, then we'll deal with it then. You don't want him, after all, to be holding everybody, to be holding it over everybody's head. I can go and sell myself to the goyim anytime I want, and you have to keep bailing me out. So that's also in the Pnei Tikkun Olam. So the Gemara deals with various angles on that point, and then the Gemara tells the following story. Rish Lakish zabin nafshe l'ludoi. Rish Lakish sold himself to the ludoi. Rashi describes that the ludoi are cannibals. Now, what's he doing selling himself to them? Now, we know from the Gemara in Bava Metzia that originally that there was a period in Rish Lakish's life when he was a bandit. Right. So some say that this was during that time in his life. Tosfos mentions over here, he certainly wouldn't have done such a thing after he did Tshuva and became a great Talmud Chacham. He wouldn't go, even if we're saying the purpose over here was that he's going to wind up killing these guys, he wouldn't do such a thing after he did Tshuva and became a Talmud Chacham. On the other hand, there are Mefarshim who learned that maybe it was during that time in his life. Maybe he realizes, you know, that these guys are dangerous guys and we got to get rid of them.
He married the daughter of Rabbi Yohanan.
He married the sister of Rabbi Yohanan, yeah.
Before that, he was very strong, but probably...
Tosfos in a couple of places in Shas explains that originally, Tosfos actually in a couple of places explains that he started out as a Talmud Chacham, Rish Lakish, then he went off the derech and became a bandit, and then Rabbi Yochanan helped him do tshuva and come back to what he was. Yeah. Either way, yes, he was very physically strong, and you have the story over there in Bava Metzia where afterwards he lost some of his strength once he accepted to learn Torah and he couldn't jump back across the river. Even so, there's Yerushalmi and Trumas that mentions that he was still tremendously strong even after he became a great Talmud Chacham. The Gemara gives an example one time where Rabbi Yochanan was mugged by some robbers and Rish Lakish chased after them and made them return all of Rabbi Yochanan's money. So now he sold himself to the Lodoy, to this group of cannibals. Shokobade chaisa v'galalta, or v'galgalta. He took along with him a bag and a round ball. Rashi describes it's a round piece of some kind of heavy material, lead or stone or something like that. Omar, he thinks to himself, Gmiri, we know that this is how it is. Gmiri literally means we learned, but, you know, we learned, doesn't we know how these guys act. The Yom Basra, on a person's last day before they're going to kill him and eat him, called the Boy Minayu Abdilay, whatever you ask of them, for your last wishes, they're going to give the person, the victim, this way he'll be moichel on his blood. In other words, even these guys have a shtick of conscience, a shtick of twisted conscience, and they don't want to kill a person where then he's going to be angry at them, and who knows, his ghosts may get back at them or something. So they figure like this, if they give him his last wishes, then he'll be moichel on it. Different explanation of deleichel adame means that his blood will be sweeter. Anyway, so he figures that's going to give me my opportunity to get them. Yoma Bastra, so it came what was supposed to be his last day. Omrulay my nichaloch, so they tell him, what do you want? Your last wishes. Omrulahu, he tells them, Be'ina mekamtinchu v'isvinchu. I want to tie each one of you up and have you sit down. V'chochad minayichu, and each one of you separately, emchiei chaisa upalga. I will strike him with 1.5 blows from this sack. So he has a sack that he's holding in his hand. They don't realize that he has the heavy ball of stone or lead inside it. So they figure, okay, he's gonna tap us with his bag. Big deal. True enough, sure enough, he tied each one of them up and sat them down. Each one of them, he hit him only once with the bag, with this heavy thing inside it. The guy was knocked for a loop. Nafak Nishmasa usually means Neshama left him, in other words, he was killed, but as we see from the story of him, he wasn't literally dead yet, it just means like he was knocked, the wind knocked out of him. Kino Lashine, the guy was in pain, so he gritted his teeth, like from the pain. Omalei, so Rish Lakish says to him, Achuchi Komachaisasbi, look at that, you're laughing at me, what do you think, that was nothing? Akati Poshlach Gabi Palgan Dechaisa, I still have a half a blow left, because I said a blow and a half in the first place. So sure enough, one by one, Katlinu Kulu, so he killed all of them. So that way he got rid of all of them. Interesting point is there's an expression in the Gemara in Bava Kamma that says that you have a case where a person, like you have an expression in English, you buy a pig in a poke, like you buy something, you get into a business deal or whatever, and you don't, you think you got something good, and it turns out that you got fleeced. It turns out that you didn't get what you expected. So an expression for that in the Gemara in Bava Kamma is chaisid kitri savras l'kablos. You thought you're getting a bag full of knots. And that's exactly what you got, is a bag full of nothing. There's an explanation that relates to our story over here. These guys thought they were getting just a tap with a bag, and then they realized they're getting a zest with what's inside the bag. Anyway, continues the Gemara. There is, by the way, a very interesting explanation from the Chassam Sofer, a drushtik explanation of what was going on over here. He says like this, the Lodori over here represent the Yetzirah. Now, the Gemara tells us in Brachas that if a person is being beset by his Yetzirah and he needs to get rid of it, the best thing is to, first the Gemara mentions living Torah, but then it says you should say Krishma, and if that doesn't help, then Yazkir lo Yom HaMisa, then mention to him the day that he's going to die. Now, the Chassam Sofer says, saying Krishma is like the entire thing. That's like the first blow we're saying over here. That can be effective and there's no downsides to it. On the other hand, Yazkir lo Yom HaMisa can backfire because the Yetzer Hara might say, as some Rishonim do, you know, Ochol v'shasa ki mochol namos. Eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we're going to die. So the fact that we're going to die, they don't care, Adarabah, they figure that gives us more chance to fulfill our tithes until then. So therefore, over here, Rish Lakish is first giving each one of them one blow, meaning the Krishma, and if that's not effective, then he's going to do the half a blow, which is Yazkir lo Yom HaMisa, mention the day of death, but realize that that's only a half because it can backfire. Okay, so the Gemara continues, Nafak va'asa Yosef, Nafak va'asa, so now he left there safely. Yosef ka'achol v'shasi, throughout his life, Rish Lakish was sitting and eating and drinking. He never, whenever he earned money, he would spend it right away. He wouldn't save from one day to the next. Omrele brate, so his daughter says to him, Lloyd Boris midil mizgale, don't you at least want a pillow or a cushion to rest on it? Amalah, he tells her, Biti, my daughter, Krasi Kri, my stomach is my pillow. Tosfos points out that there's actually a Gemara in Zvokin that mentions that Rish Lakish used to do that. He would lie on his stomach. He would lie on his stomach. The Gemara even mentions over there one time he was lying on his stomach and then talking a concept in Torah. In Halacha, by the way, it says you're not supposed to lie directly on your stomach, so it means he wasn't completely, it means he was turned a little bit on his side, but the point is, in other words, he didn't think that he needs something else to be comfortable. And the Gemara continues, Ki noch nafshe, when Rish Lakish passed away many years later, shavat kaba demurika. Like we said, he always spent whatever he had. All he left over was one kab of saffron, a spice. Korah nafshe, he applied to himself the pasuk, v'ozvul acherim chelam, they leave, what the pasuk says, until him, they leave over their wealth for others. In other words, he regretted the fact that he had this to leave over for his Yoshim, that the He planned not to leave anything. Maharsha refers to over here to a Gemara in Eruvin that says that it's not the person shouldn't think to himself, I have to leave a Yerusha, I have to leave a lot of wealth for my children. It's the Eibishter gives you what you need. You don't have to worry about what's going to be in the future for your descendants. Now, the fact is, though, that and one point of it is, because the Gemara mentions over there, you never know. Your descendants are not necessarily going to use that money wisely. They may not be such tzaddikim. Shlomo HaMelech mentioned such a concept in Kehelas, for example. He says, you know, I feel bad. I feel bad that I'm going to leave my wealth to whoever comes after me, and who knows if he's going to be wise and use it wisely or if he's going to be foolish. In the event, Shlomo HaMelech's successor was Rechava. Mutaka did not use his legacy wisely. Anyway, so that's one reason why Rish Lakish then regretted that he left over anything at all. With that said, though, there are Mephoshim who point out, I mean, the fact is, in other places we see in the Gemara that it can be a good thing to leave something for your Yoshim. So why is Rish Lakish regretting it? So there's a couple of other reasons that are given. One of the Mephoshim on Ein Yaakov called Ein Eliyahu gives a reason, given that we said before there was a period in his life when Rish Lakish was a bandit. The halacha is, when a person steals from people, he has to return them whatever he stole. And if he doesn't know how, if he doesn't know who he stole from, then he has to use it for tzorchei tzibur, for public works projects. The Gemara gives an example, for example, for digging wells to provide people with a water supply. And that way, hopefully, eventually, the people who were stolen from will be able to benefit from it as well. So now, the Shlokish figured, anything he owns, anything he earns, anything beyond what he needs for his immediate needs, he has to be using to pay back the people he stole from over the many, many years ago. So now he feels bad that he left something over, that he didn't manage to accomplish that fully. And the Chofetz Chaim gives yet another reason as well. Every time, every moment of his time is precious. He can be learning Torah with it. So the time that he spent earning this tav of saffron, and now it turns out he doesn't need it for himself. So it turns out, in retrospect, that that time was wasted. Hanizok in Perek Hamishi, so the beginning of the Perek continues by talking about things that are mpnei tikkun olam. So one of the things it mentions is you have various kinds of cases where a person owes money for different kinds of debts, and then if those debts are going to be paid off with land, there's different qualities of land that the people in question are entitled to take. The rule is hanizokin, which is why the parak begins with that. The people who to whom you've caused a nezek, that the Torah says they're entitled to collect from idis, from the best of your land. Then you have balichoy, you owe people money. Then it's beninis, average quality land, and the ksubas isha is paid out from ziburis, from the worst quality land, and the Gemara goes and deals with the ins and outs of those dinim. So in that connection, the Gemara mentions Tanya, Omer Reb Shimon, Mipnei Ma Omru Hanizokin Shaman Lahem Beidis. Why did they say that Nizokin, that people to whom you've caused the hezek, their payment is evaluated using the best quality land? Now, the Omru is a little hard to understand because not the Chachamim who said it. It says right there in the pasuk, Metav Sadeu, Metav Karmi Yishalim. So the Rif, not the Rif here on Ein Yaakov, the original Rif, the Rishon, has a girsa instead Mipnei Ma Omru Torah, which fits better. Why did the Torah say? We find in a number of places in Shas that this is Reb Shimon's style, Dorish Taima Dekra. He regularly tries to find the reason behind the mitzvah in the Torah and to apply even to deduce various details of the din from it. So here also he wants to find a reason behind what the Torah says. Why does the Torah assign the Nizak Idis? So he says, Mipnei Gazlonim or Mipnei Chamsonim, because of robbers and because of Chamsonim. The difference is that Gazlon takes the land without paying for it. Or takes anything without paying for it. A chamson forces the person to sell it to him. He extorts it out of him and forces him. He says, I'll give you money. I'm not going to steal it. But he forces and extorts the other person to give it to him, which in that he's over on Lois Sachnoid. In any case, the point is, Kadesh Yerma Odom, this way a person will say to himself, Lomani Gozov, Lomani Chomis, why should I bother robbing or extorting from people? Lamocha based in, I'm going to be a mazik then. Lamocha based in Yodin Lanachosai, eventually based in are going to come into my property to make me pay, to seize property from me to pay my victims. Venotlan Sodi Narshali, and they're going to take my nice field because the Torah says it is. Vesonchan Amashakosaba Torah, Metav Sadeo, Metav Tami Yashalim, and they're going to be relying on. They have a valid basis for it, because the Torah says that a mazik has to pay from the best of his field and the best of his vineyard. So therefore, this way it'll dissuade him in the first place from being a gazlan or a chamsan, realizing that he's going to lose more than he gains. There are, in fact, some mafarshim we're talking about over here, where he figures Like this, he might steal a field or a piece of property or whatever and then damage it, and then we're talking about over here, then he's going to be a damage or a mazik, and then we're saying that he's gonna have his best collected from him. Okay, further on in the parak, it talks about another, more on the topic of Mepei Tikkun HaOlam. It starts talking about the dinim of an apotropos. You have a person passes away, and he leaves young children. So you have either he appoints or based in appoints an apotropos, a trustee, a caretaker, to take care of the property of these Simon until they're old enough to manage it themselves. So there's the Mishnah deals and the Gemara deals in more detail with the various dinim about an apotropos, what his responsibilities are, what his rights are, etc., and the fact that Basin has to supervise him, etc., etc. The Gemara mentions in that connection, by the way, the expression that Basin is avim shel yisoimim, that Basin is like they're in loco parentis, they're in the place of the parent of the yisoimim, so therefore they have to oversee the apotropos and make sure he's doing the job correctly. And the Rambam mentions at the end of Hilchos Nachlas, also for that matter, the apotropos has to realize for himself that ultimately the real father of the yisoimim is Hashem, and he's answerable to him, and therefore make sure that he does everything honestly. Anyway, in the course of discussing these halachos, the Gemara mentions the point that the apotropos, he has to manage the yisoimim's property as wisely and as best as possible, and that includes, in particular, he shouldn't be selling land in order to buy metaltalin, because land is more permanent than metaltalin. Those can get lost or stolen or destroyed or what have you, whereas land is a more permanent asset, and therefore if they inherited land, it would be bad management to go and sell that land in favor of something else. So the Gemara tells a story. How who apotropos to have a b'shivav usay did a mayor. There was an apotropos who lived in a mayor's neighborhood to have a kamazvin arosa v'zabin avdi. He was doing that. He was selling land that he was selling on behalf of the yisoimim, land that they had inherited from their parents, v'zabin avdi, and instead he was using that money to buy slaves for them. V'leshavke Reb Meir was not letting him do that because, as we said, that's the halacha. Is he not supposed to be doing that? If he wants to do it with his own nechosim, then that's fine. But when he's managing it on behalf of the yisoimim, he has to keep to a higher standard. Well, the Gemara says, Achzulei b'chelma, Reb Meir was shown afterwards in a dream an onu or ani laharis va'ata livnes. What's going on over here? We and Shemayim are trying to destroy this property of these yisoimim, and you're trying to build it up. Meaning the Marashal explains, their father had earned his money just doing with some kind of dishonest way, or some Avera, or something, and therefore, Minash Mayim, they wanted those Nechosim to be lost. So therefore, so we would rather that this apotropos goes and does what he wants, and you shouldn't interfere, you shouldn't mix in. Nevertheless, Reb Meir did not pay any attention to that dream. Omar, he says, dreams don't bring up and they don't take down. Meaning, in other words, you can't learn anything in halacha from dreams. The Gemara mentions this point in some other places as well. For example, the Gemara mentions, let's say, a person has a dream where his father tells him the money that you find in such and such a place is Maaser Sheni money, for example, and therefore you can't use it yourself, you have to bring it to your Shalayim. Even if you find the exact amount of money in the exact place that you were told in the dream, you're not required to treat it as Maaser Sheni money, because, as the Gemara tells us in Brachos, all dreams have an element of, or most dreams have an element of nonsense in them, and therefore you never know, that particular detail might be the nonsense, and therefore you're not obligated to follow it. Of course, we do find that same Gemara in Brachas has a whole bunch of discussion of dreams where you do learn something from, and of course we have in the Torah many dreams that had great significance. The Gemara itself points out there's a difference between dreams that are through a malach or through a shed and various other distinctions. There's a bunch of explanations among Rishonim what exactly the distinction is, but in any case, Reb Meir held over here that this dream that he had is not one of those ones that has significance, and therefore he's entitled to ignore it, and the halacha is the halacha, and he should prevent this apotropos from doing what he's doing. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, the Rebbe's father, has a very interesting Kabbalistic explanation of what's going on over here. He says the deeper thing behind all of this apotropos is actually none other than Malach Matat. And he explains how Matat is, so to speak, Hashem runs the entire world through him, as Gemara mentions in Chagiga and in other places, and therefore he can be called, so to speak, the apotropos of the world. Meanwhile, Reb Meir has a certain connection to Malach Matat as well, and Reb Levik explains how that is. And in addition, he also has a connection with Yosef. Reb Meir has a connection with Yosef. So Malach Matat is saying, in other words, we don't need land, which we explained represents Malchus. We need slaves, which represents a different sphere. And Reb Meir says that, no, you know, think about it. I'm standing in for Yosef. Yosef himself was sold as a slave. He has an interest in there not being slaves. And he has an interest in land. We see, for example, what happened when the Mitzrayim are starving during the famine over there. And they come to Yosef and offer that you should buy our land and ourselves, that our land with the land of Mitzrayim will belong to Paray, and we ourselves will be slaves to Paray. What does the Pasuk say? It says he bought the land. It doesn't say he bought them themselves. Because Yosef has no interest in there being slaves. He has an interest in purchasing land. So therefore, that fits with Rameh over here, opposing Malach Matat's agenda of getting rid of the land and buying slaves instead. And then he goes on to say, so the dream represents the dream comes from Malach Gavriel, which represents Dvura, and he's being told Menashemayim that they don't like these Yisoimim because of the way they're acting. He apparently learns that it was the Yisoimim themselves who were acting wrongly, not like Marashal, but it was their father. And nevertheless, your mayor says, Dibri Chalom Islam Alam Vlemiridin, doesn't matter, I'm still sticking to my guns. Well, the Gemara tells now another story, also where the mayor deals with the situation. On the surface, the reason why the Gemara brings it is another example where it wasn't necessarily Reb Meir didn't necessarily have to mix in, and nevertheless he did in order to help out people. So this is the second story is Hanu Beit Shei de Igri Bahu Satan Kol Beit Shimshi. There were these two people, the pastors, a couple. Every Beit Shimshi, the Satan would be provoking them into a fight. Beit Shimshi literally means Bein HaShemoshes. Rashi explains specifically means Bein HaShemoshes of Erev Shabbos, going into Shabbos. We learned in Ksubas. Rashi explains any days Bein HaShemoshes can be called Beit Shimshi, but in Gemara terminology, they usually use it to mean Friday night Bein HaShemoshes, because unlike every other day in the week, it doesn't matter so much, let's say Bein HaShemoshes from Tuesday going into Wednesday. It doesn't much matter for most purposes whether it's Tuesday or Wednesday, but there's a big difference between Friday and Shabbos, and therefore the term Beit Shimshi came to be used to mean Friday night. So now these two people, the Satan was getting into them every Friday night, and they were fighting with one another. Have a kominsu, b'havi adodi, so that every Friday night they were arguing with one another. Ikla Reb Meir lahosam. Reb Meir visited that place. Akvinu tlosa Beit Shimshi. He held them with him. He kept them with him. Engaged them in conversation or whatever. Did other things with them for three Bein HaShemoshes in a row, for three Friday nights in a row. Ad da'ovid lahu shloma, until he was able to make shalom between them. Shamei de Ka'omer, then he heard the Satan saying, Vai, woe, apke Reb Meir, lahu gavim v'beise, Reb Meir has kicked that person, meaning me, out of his house. In other words, until now, I had a nice house over here in this place where this couple is quarreling every Erev Shabbos, and now I've been evicted from there thanks to Reb Meir. So again, the Poshet reason, Maharam Shif says that the reason why this story is brought in the Gemara, the same way as in the previous story with Apoturkos, Reb Meir didn't have to deal with it. He could have said, fine, he's in my neighborhood, it's not particularly my business, the local based in will deal with it. And still, Reb Meir took it on himself to intervene. The same way over here, Reb Meir could have said, okay, neighbors are fighting, what can you do, that's how it is. But nevertheless, he took it on himself to intervene, and he was successful. Reb Levitt goes on in his explanation over there to explain a deeper reason behind it. He says that actually the two people over here are the very same Yisroimim from the previous story. So therefore, so already we see that they were against them in Shemayim, and here we see that they're fighting every Erev Shabbos, Bein HaShemoshes, and Reb Meir is forced to, and Reb Meir has to go make peace between them.
The story is about a wife and a...
Well, it doesn't say, it just says Beit Shrei, just says two people. So Reb Levitt understands that it's the Yisroimim themselves, or at least the Ruchni, or there's something, somebody related to them in a Ruchniistic source. He talks about they represent Netzach and Hoid. Anyway, he explains why after three Friday nights he needed in order to patch up things between them. First of all, we see, for example, in Shalom Aleichem, we say Shalom three times. Also, he says the three Friday nights we're talking about over here may actually have been the 3 weeks of the 3 weeks during the year. That's a particular time when there's Xeris there, when there's a time of Dinim Koshim, as we're going to soon learn now, the whole Agadah about the Churban. So therefore, Davka then is why the mayor has to get them to be at peace, to counteract the Sinas Chinam that brought to the Churban. Worth telling in this connection, by the way, an interesting story that I read many, many years ago involving the Shver of Reb Chaim Oizer. Reb Chaim Oizer, everyone knows, was the Rav of Vilna up to 1940. He was Nifter, so his Shver was also one of the Rabbanim of Vilna back in the day. So the story goes that there was this couple that also every Erev Shabbos they would be fighting because, in particular on the winter Erev Shabbos, the husband would be getting home late from work, the wife is busy with all the children and everything and hasn't had the time to clean up the house and set everything for Shabbos, so they would end up fighting. So and then part of the problem was also that there's this rich lady in the neighborhood, this rich Yiddish lady who takes in Shabbos very early. So now the guy comes home, the poor Yid comes home, and he sees already Shabbos candles are lit by the neighbor, and he starts thinking it's Shabbos already, and he's coming home, and why isn't everything ready yet? And it ends up fighting. So what does this Rav do? Reb Grodensky was his name. Interesting that his last name was Grodensky. His Adam's name was Grodensky. Anyway, but anyway, Reb Eliezer, I think, was his first name. I don't remember. Anyway, so what he does is, when he sees this is going on, one Erev Shabbos, he takes out his pipe and he sits on his porch smoking until the last moment before Shabbos begins. And meanwhile, so now this guy comes home. First he sees the Shabbos candle. Wait a minute, it's almost Shabbos. Wait a second, if the Rav is sitting, the Dayan is sitting over here and smoking, it's obviously not Shabbos yet. There's plenty of time. We have nothing to worry about, and he pitches in and helps in the house, and shalom is made.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara goes on with more things with Takana Sashalim. So one Takana is that when a Gazlan wants to do tshuva, so we shouldn't necessarily accept the payment back from him. Here we said before, Rish Lakish, for example, according to one explanation, throughout his life is trying to pay back his victim, but it's not always a good thing that Beis Din should allow people to accept it. Again, with Takana Sashalim, because otherwise a person may say to himself, you know what, then in that case, I'm going to have to give away everything I own, then I can't be bothered, and he'll never do tshuva. The Gemara, in fact, tells of a person that was in just that situation, he's ready to return everything that he stole. His wife tells him, he realizes he's going to be left with absolutely nothing, so he gave it up and never did tshuva. So therefore the Chum said, other things, in many cases, you shouldn't have the Gazlan return what he stole. So the Gemara mentions in this connection, a Takana, Tanan Abanan, Gozal Morish, if a person stole a beam, Ubnoi Bebira, and he built it into a building. So now what happens when he wants to do tshuva? Beis Shammai mekakeh kol habira kula. Beis Shammai says he would have to tear down the whole building if necessary, or machzim morish lebalav, and return the beam to the owner. Or Beis Shammai, and Beis Shammai says, no, ein la ela d'med morish bilbad, the victim of the theft is only entitled to the value of the beam. Again, mishum takonas hashavim, because of takonas hashavim. We want to make it as easy as possible for people to do tshuva. If he thinks he's going to have to tear down his whole building, it's going to dissuade him from doing tshuva. So like this, if he knows that he can manage with only paying the money, then that makes it much easier for him to do tshuva. And that's Sakad Halacha, as the Gemara actually mentions in Masechta Sukkah, by the same token, if a person were to steal a beam and build it into his sukkah, then during the 7 days of sukkah, he's also potter from returning it, and he can just return the money. The Medrash also mentions, by the way, in connection with the people of Nineveh, that when Yonah comes to them and warns them that the city is going to be overturned because of all your theft and robbery and everything else, so they were doing tshuva, as we have in the Psukim over there, even to the extent that they were tearing down their buildings and returning the original, and returning the actual beams. So they weren't availing themselves of any takonas hashavim like that. They were going to the nth degree.
That was Kidrug on him.
Anyway, that's why Yonah didn't want to go to them in the first place, because he realized that it's very much easier for them to do tshuva. They're not as beset by the Yetzer Hara as we are, and therefore if they do tshuva, it's going to reflect really badly on the Jewish people. Yeah. Yeah, the Medrash uses the expression at it that Tova Kvoida Ben, but like Tova Kvoida Ab. He was concerned more for the honor of the Jewish people more than for the honor of Hashem, because after all, Hashem gives you a job to do. You don't run away from it, but yeah. Sacrifice himself for the Yidden is one thing, but still, you know, a person has it. In fact, by the way, it's interesting. Actually, a few days ago in Daf Yomi, the Gemara had mentioned in Sanhedrin that if a Novi shekovash nevuase, that if a Novi withholds his nevuah and doesn't tell it, then he's chayev misa. And the Gemara gives an example over there of Yonah. The question is, Yonah didn't end up suffering misa for being kovash nevuase. So one answer is, in fact, that because the Eibishter took into consideration the fact that he was doing it in order to stand up on behalf of the Jewish people, so therefore instead he had to go through the yisurim of being thrown into the ocean and swallowed up by the fish and go through all that sodas instead of actual misa. Okay. So the Gemara, so now another Takonas Hashavim thing that it mentions is, the Mishnah says, Loi hoya sikrikun b'Yehuda b'harugei ha-mochama. There's a concept, there's a Takon of the Chachamim made called sikrikun. So the name sikrikun itself actually refers to a goyish extortioner. This is a person who threatens to kill a yid if he doesn't give him his property. So, in fact, Rashi mentions that Sikrikun is short for Sokarka. The Yid tells him, take my land and don't kill me. So now, the Chachamim made a takana. Now, the Sikrikun himself, the Goyish extortionist, is usually not going to keep the land for himself. He's usually going to want to unload it on somebody else. He's going to want to sell it to somebody else and make a few dollars that way. So the Chachamim made a takana that when another Yid is buying it from him, then he has to do something to compensate the original owner. And the Gemara goes through, actually, various further on in the Perek, it goes on with different details of different times. The Chacham made different takonis at different times, how exactly that compensation should be done. On the one hand, you want to encourage a Yid to buy it so Taka doesn't remain in the hands of the Goy. On the other hand, you want to compensate the original owner for it because he had to give it away for no good reason. So therefore, sort of Chacham had to balance the conflicting things. But the Mishnah says that at the time of Haruge HaMolchama, at the time of the war immediately preceding and following the Korban, then the Takana of Sikrikun did not apply. Because at that time, and the Gemara mentions, it's not here in Ein Yaakov, but the Gemara mentions that there was a period of time over there during the years immediately before and immediately after the Korban when Jewish blood was very cheap. There was a period when the Romans were actually saying any Roman who doesn't kill a Yid is going to be put to death. You know, like during the Holocaust, you know. And then you have a period when they were saying any Goy who kills a Jew will have to pay like a symbolic fine, 4 zuzim, like next to nothing. So at times like that, you have to figure that the Yid who gives away his land to the Sikrikun is, to a certain extent, it's not voluntary at all, of course, but in other words, he realizes that, look, his life really is in danger and he has no real recourse to taking the Goy to court or something. As opposed to in more normal times, when a Goy does this kind of thing, the Yid thinks to himself, you know what, yes, this guy is an extortionist and a mafia nick and whatever, but after all, later on, I can take him to court and get him to give me back what he took from me. So therefore, if meanwhile another Yid buys it, then he's preventing the first Yid, the owner, from doing that, and therefore he should have to compensate the original owner. So the Mishnah says that at the time of Haruge HaMolchama, the whole takana of Sikrikun didn't apply, because then it was a unique situation when Jews were being killed all over the place, Rahman al-Flan. Tosfos mentions in this connection, so why Dafke and Yehuda, and brings from the Yerushalmi, the Romans had it in particularly for Shevet Yehuda. Because we have the story, we'll learn it in Gemara Sota in a few weeks, Bezat Hashem, that when they came to bury Yaakov Avinu, so Esav comes with a complaint, I should own half of the place in Maris Machpela, and then Yaakov already used one of the spaces for Leah, and I should get the other one, and they have to go and, but you sold your rights there in Yaakov, well, where's the shtar? And they have to send Naphtali back to Mitzrayim to run quickly and get the shtar. Meanwhile, Chushan ben Don gives Esav a zets and knocks him down, and then the Yerushalmi said, now, Chushan then, so that's as far as the Bavli tells the story. The Yerushalmi then continues the story, and says that Chushim didn't actually kill him, he just knocked him for a loop. Then Yehuda actually came and killed him, thus fulfilling the pasuk, Yodcha b'odef oivecha. Your hand is against the neck of your enemies. So now the Romans, who are descended from Esav, they held it even a thousand and more years later against Shevet Yehuda, and therefore they made their gzeiras against Yehuda particularly cruel, including therefore that led to the din of our Mishnah. So based on that, he was where the Gemara has the whole Agadta about the Korban, about all the war that led up to the Korban and all of that, which we'll start learning tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, unless Be'ez Hashem Mashiach will come first, and then we'll learn that Gemara on a whole different level. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach Ogo'ola, Chof Adabez. Chazal tell us, the expression in Baba Basra, Asidin Tzadikim Shi Omer Lefneim Kodesh. In the future, the Kodesh will be said in front of the Tzadikim, like the way they say in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So in other words, Tzadikim are going to be on such a high level that relative to the Malachim, they're going to seem like on a level close to the Eibishter, and then therefore they're going to say Kodesh in front of them. There's a lot of places in Chassidus where it talks about the deeper meaning, what that is, but in any case, the Rebbe talks about in the Sicha, all the Giluyim of La'asid Lava, all the revelations of all the course, all depend on what we do during the time of Golos. So therefore, this Asidim Tzadikim, and Tzadikim means the entire Jewish people, V'amach Kolim Tzadikim, is as a result of the Avoida of during the time of Golos. Namely, how do we become Kodesh as a positive? You should make yourselves holy and be holy, as in the avoda of kaddish atzmacha b'mutar lach, that even things that are mutar to you, you have to be makaddish yourself and show restraint in it, and behold, everything you're doing is for the sake of the Eibishter, not just in order to enjoy your gashmiistic pleasures. So with that, in other words, we make ourselves kaddish, and with that we end up with the asidim tzadikim shiyom lefneim kaddish. Continuing on halachas of Erev Chatzeres, we were talking about yesterday, by the way, Yisroel Mumur, Mechal Shabbos for Fahesia, that he's considered like a goy. So I brought up the question, so what about a Tinnik Shanishba, Rabbi Elzebel Zangazon, pointed out that actually, in any case, you have another din as well, which he doesn't mention over here in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which is you have a person who's not moida be'eruv, a person who doesn't hold of the concept of Erev Chatzeres, even if otherwise he's considered a frum yid, other than that, he's a Shema Torah Mitzvah, but doesn't believe in the concept of Erev. And the examples back then with Tzedukim or Karoim or whatever, then anyway, you can't join him in an Eruv. So therefore, so it's kind of a moot point if about a Tinnik Shanishba, because in any case, as of right now, he's not Moedib Eruv, and therefore, in any case, you can't really join him in the Eruv anyway. So we'll learn more Dinim about it tomorrow, Beis Hashem.